Radio 1 DJ Dave Lee Travis has denied groping two women and stressed that the allegations against him have nothing to do with children. He was arrested yesterday by detectives who were involved in the investigation into the Jimmy Savile abuse scandal. He told reporters that he wants to make sure that his name isn't associated with child abuse.
This is nothing to do with kids, because that, to me, is the most important thing in the world. And I do not wish to have my name sullied.
The Labour Party has won the Corby by-election.
Do hereby declare that Andrew Sawford is duly elected as the
Andy Sawford won it by a margin of almost 8,000 votes. It's the first time in 15 years that Labour's won a common seat from the Tories in a by-election. An investigation into poor voter numbers for the police and crime commissioners has been launched by the elections watchdog. The average turnout across the country was 15%. The highest was 20% in Avon and Somerset. The lowest was in the West Midlands. Kate Gose from the Electoral Reform Society says the government has serious questions to answer.
These elections have been a comedy of errors from start to finish, from holding them on a dark November day through to utterly failing to give voters the information they wanted about what the elections were about or who they were voting for.
IKEA says it deeply regrets the use of forced prison labour by suppliers in communist East Germany more than two decades ago. The company commissioned a report following allegations aired by a Swedish TV documentary in June. That's the latest. I'm Chris Giles.
BCFM.
Hello, Bristol, and welcome to BCFM's politics show, Friday Drive Time. Tony Gosling, and helping us review this week's news on election results day is Lib Dem MP for Bristol West, Stephen Williams. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. As of today, three people, the Mayor, that's George Ferguson, the Police and Crime Commissioner and the Chief Constable, will be able to steer the destinies of Bristol's 430,000 people. And the Mayor will control a budget of £1 billion. So, will it be a new start for the city or a virtual dictatorship? Only time will tell. In the second hour after six, the energy vampires. Wholesale petrol prices have gone down 10 pence a litre in the last month. The price at the pump's only gone down 2p, as gas rates are the new LIBOR. The energy industry may be running the world, but as of this week, we know too that it's fleecing the public. And if the government complains, simple, it just seems to buy them off. David Powell's here, our beacon of hope and sanity in a world driven mad, from Friends of the Earth, with the assassination also of the Palestinian Army Chief of Staff, tension and deaths mounting in the Israeli-Gaza border, so we ask what effect, if any, the crisis in Syria is likely to have on the plight of the Palestinians, who are being forced to live in what is effectively a vast prison camp. Also, how democratic is the city of London? A new film, Secret City, from Lee Salter, head of journalism at our very own University of the West of England. And as ever, Martin Summers takes us on a tour of the world's hotspots. That's all in the second hour after six. On to our news review in a minute, but first Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 7 Celsius and dry. This weekend, highs of 10, cloudy on Saturday with some light rain, sunny on Sunday. Next week, highs of 11, fairly cloudy week with some heavy showers. Next weekend, 24th and 25th of November, highs of 7 Celsius, fairly sunny but feeling cold. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So, helping us review this week's news is Lib Dem MP for Bristol West, Stephen Williams. Hi, Stephen. Welcome to Drive Time.
Good evening.
Now, first of all, Stephen, the result today, George Ferguson, you were saying just as you arrived just now, this is a great result. Surely the great result would have been if the Liberal Democrat had been elected.
Well, I've known George for over 25 years. I got involved in sort of politics big time when I was a student at Bristol University in the mid to late 1980s. So George was the first candidate I voted for in the 1987 general election. I was actually on his campaign team. So I've known him a long time, and he was a Liberal councillor for my old council ward of Cabot as well. He's made a great contribution to the city, not just in politics, but in the arts as well, with the foundation of the tobacco factory and various other regeneration projects. And yeah, I mean, obviously I would have preferred heard it if John Rogers, the official Liberal Democrat candidate, had won. But George Ferguson is a...
The unofficial.
Well, he's a small L Liberal, I suppose. Well, I have to settle for now mayor of the city. I'm sure he'll be inclusive in his cabinet choices. A lot of people have forgotten, we haven't effectively anointed a monarch today. We have actually elected a mayor who will have to choose a team of people from amongst the 70 councillors to help him run the city. And the Liberal Democrats are still the largest party on the city council, so I would imagine that George is going to be picking up the phone to some of my councillor colleagues on Bristol City Council and asking them to join his administration, and I hope they can work together.
Martin Summers, this is a desperate result for Labour. I mean, really, looking on a national scale, what on earth is going on? You've had two entire years now, plus 2.5 years of Conservative Lib Dem coalition government. If Labour cannot win a vote like this in a city that has traditionally been a Labour city, you really have no chance at all in the next general election. And this is a really dire warning to Labour that they better get their act together before the next general election, otherwise you're a has-been party.
Well, it's an election for mayor in Bristol is not a normal election of the kind that we've seen before. And first of all, can I congratulate George on his emphatic victory? Because he didn't just win, we thought he might win on transfer votes, but he won, he didn't get an overall majority in the first round, but he was definitely well ahead. And I think that's a fairly convincing mandate for him to run the city for 4 years. We've got to go away as the local Labour Party and have a look at what we did right or wrong or whatever. I think we came second in certain parts of the city. Our support is solid, and of course all three by-elections today, which we had to win, we won. But of course I'm not complacent in any way. I mean, some of the things you say we're going to have to think about and look into quite seriously.
Yes. So what do you think went wrong? Because I would have thought if Labour had any chance at the next general election, they are sort of flying the flag for the poor, for the working poor and unemployed people and many others. For now, it seems certainly in Bristol that there is no one flying the flag for them at all. The Labour Party have completely failed, haven't they?
Well, I wouldn't agree with that, because I think, as Stephen said, George is a small L Liberal. He's not a right-wing fanatic by any stretch of the imagination, and I think he will govern Bristol from the centre. We haven't convinced enough people that we can do that, and it's a rather unusual election because it's an independent has generated a bandwagon, which is a bit like George Galloway winning in Bradford. It's an upset result, certainly for us.
Stephen, what are your thoughts then about what changes this is going to make for the city? It's an important person, important change. I quite find it intriguing that you're almost sort of talking about George Ferguson as the unofficial Liberal candidate, because he was a Liberal councillor in the past. Do you think that he's actually going to be able to work well with the Liberals because he's been an ex-Liberal councillor? Because he's been put across as someone who's completely independent of party politics. But obviously, he's not entirely independent if he's been a Liberal previously.
Well, I suppose everyone who stands as an independent, maybe this is something we ought to talk about over the next few years, because a lot of people have said they don't like party politics and they don't like bickering between politicians and wish we could just have do away with all that. And I say, well, try living in a country where there isn't that choice then. China's just chosen its leader for the next 10 years. That's what that's what a country without politics looks like. So there's an awful lot of funny stuff has been said by people about why independents are doing well and whether this is a curse on all your houses as political parties, which I think does deserve further examination. But in terms of what it means for Bristol, I think first of all people will be able to identify with an individual who is responsible for everything that the city council does. They'll know who to go to, who to complain to. So I hope George is going to be accessible.
He'll be a busy man, won't he?
Yeah, I mean, I hope he's going to be accessible to everyone around Bristol. I've just come here from holding my weekly advice surgery. I do it at the council house. Apparently next time I go there, it's going to be called City Hall. I think that's one of George's promises, one of the easiest ones I think he's going to be able to discharge. But hopefully he's going to hold, come and meet the mayor sessions like I hold and the other MPs hold, come and meet the MP sessions on a weekly basis as well. Because a lot of what comes to me is actually gripes about the way the city is run. It's not really down to me. I'm responsible for foreign policy, defence, the macroeconomy, etc. But an awful lot of what people come to their Member of Parliament about is disgruntlement about the city. There will will now be a mayor that they can go to about that. I think he will help with relations with central government, and that's where I can help him, because obviously I know a lot of the ministers involved in sort of regional policy. Nick Clegg, the Deputy Prime Minister, is actually in charge of something we've called the City Deals Programme, which is devolution of power out of London and large amounts of money as well to city regions. Bristol's got a city deal in place, and it was made clear by the Deputy Prime Minister that once we got the mayor, then we'd be able to go back for another deal. So I think, you know, one of the big things that the new mayor will have to sort out is our transport right across the greater Bristol area. So I'm sure George will want to be forging a good relationship with Nick Clegg.
Does that mean liquidating First Group?
If only we could. If only we could. It should mean, I think, what we need is the equivalent, you know, of what I see in London when I'm in London, of a Transport for London, where the Mayor of London is in charge of Transport for London. They set bus fares. You know, with your Oyster card, you can travel just about anywhere in a bus on London for £1.30.
Now, I mean, it doesn't really bode well, does it, for First? Because, you know, running the train services and also running our bus services here, that the way that the franchise on the West Coast Main Line was arranged was shown to be wrong. You know, I wonder whether some of the franchises, whether the main one from Paddington, from here to Paddington, was there problems with that? This is a serious problem, isn't it? I mean, you know, quite clearly, Richard Branson has done the right thing by bringing to the attention of the public and also the government, you know, certain flaws, it appears, in the way that those franchises were awarded. So, you know, isn't there just a problem basically with transparency when it comes to privatisation of transport? Isn't that essentially what's at the root of this?
That's an issue with the rail franchise, the mainline rail services. To be honest, the Bristol mayor does not have any remit over that. What the new mayor George Ferguson will have a say over is the development of a sort of a branch line network in Greater Bristol, enhancing the Severn Beach line, getting lines perhaps out to Portishead, the line around the top of the city around Henbury, sort of building the Bristol Metro, which is actually a reasonably good cross-party consensus in Bristol amongst the four political parties. That's what we need to do.
So do you think
the mayor's now going to have to deliver on that?
Yeah, but do you think it may have taken a mayor to actually bang heads together and actually get that moving?
Well, to be fair, I mean, heads did not need banning together in Bristol.
So why hasn't it happened so far?
A consensus has emerged that's what we needed to do. In the past, there has been difficulty, in particular in between Bristol and South Gloucestershire. I mean, if you want to resolve something from the past, rather than rail privatisation, I'd say what has bedevilled transport policy in Bristol was the dismemberment of Avon County Council back in 1996 into four fragmented unitary authorities, which together, as they were as Avon, was a natural travel to work area and an economic sub-region.
Okay.
It would have made much more sense to have kept that. But, you know, the mayor's going to have to work across these boundaries, working with Bath, working with North Somerset and South Gloucestershire, but also working with national government, and I hope I can help George on that front.
So we have a mayor. It's George Ferguson, former merchant venturer. I'm not sure quite if he's given up his merchant venturer's membership yet. He pledged to do so, didn't he, if he was elected, or when he was elected.
I'm
I seem
sure
to remember
what
him
membership
saying.
Of the merchant venturers entails, actually, apart from nice lunches, I believe.
Yes, and meetings with the Queen next week as well, possibly, when she comes to Bristol next Thursday.
He'll be doing that in his new civic role.
So he'll be leaving the merchant venturers, but he'll be attending with a different hat on next week. So, Martin, George was declared the city's first directly elected mayor with a total of 37,300 or so votes. 6,000 more than Labour's Marvin Rees in the second place. Now, that's actually quite a large percentage, isn't it? That's something like 20% under the total that he needed, Marvin, to pit George at the post. I come back to you and say, well, what needs to happen with the Labour Party for you to stand a chance of actually taking back control of a city which, you know, for decades was a Labour city?
Well, to be honest with you, I'm at a loss to say, because I haven't actually seen the breakdown of the figures.
Well, I've just told you that.
But is that
20% on the second ballot?
On the second ballot.
Yes.
Now, I was under the impression that he was ahead on the first ballot. Now, that's quite an important...
No, Ferguson was ahead on the first ballot.
Yeah, so he was ahead on the first ballot.
But, I mean, we did discuss this all last week, and we were absolutely right that these were the two front runners.
That was fairly clear.
Yeah.
But 20% less than Ferguson. The thing is, for many people, they would have voted for the second preference for Marvin, whereas maybe they'd have, you know, sort of on the left. You know, you have to do something. All right, but what has gone wrong, Martin?
All right, but let me just... it'll be interesting to me to see the figures properly, which will, no doubt we will over
but
the next couple of
forget the figures
minutes.
For a minute. What have you done wrong?
What's interesting to see whether the Tories transferred their votes. That's very interesting to see whether they just voted for Jeff Gollop and they didn't transfer their votes. We've got to analyse. This is a different kind of election, and it takes a while to take in the effects. I think it's fairly clear that the appeal of the Labour Party is very much within our core constituency as things stand.
But what
so we've got to think about how we're going to reach out beyond that if we're going to have any chance of running Bristol.
So was it personality and charisma or policies, do you think, that Marvin fell down on?
Well, I think it's a number of things, and we'll need to... I haven't actually had time to think about this properly. So I'm still reeling. I mean, yes, inevitably. I mean, people have been involved in the campaign over the last 10 days or so. We've all been running around. We've all been very involved. I'm sure Stephen knows how it is.
But the National Labour Party... still thinking about we'll be, we'll be looking at Bristol Labour Party and tutting, saying, what are you guys doing down there?
Well, that will have to be looked at. I mean, I'm not quite sure how it will play out.
Yeah, I mean let's not forget, I mean, this was bigged up by the Labour Party quite a lot. I mean, Marvin Rees, who I actually quite like. I think he's an engaging, charismatic character, and I hope he can make some other contribution to Bristol public life. But he had a starring role at the Labour Party conference, at his own platform speech. He introduced Ed Miliband, who I understand was scheduled to be arriving in Bristol around about now to hail the victory. No doubt he had to turn back on his way down. This really is something they ought to have won quite easily, given where the coalition government is at the moment, and given where my own party, the Liberal Democrats, are in the national opinion polls, and we are the largest party in Bristol. It should have been an easy knockover result for the Labour Party.
Well, having said that,
and they failed.
Having said that, I mean, I think actually George ran an amazing PR campaign.
He did.
I mean, his. I noticed at home. I mean, I didn't even get a polling card this year for whatever reason. No polling card appeared through my door. So, but I went out and found the polling station anyway, which is the usual place the Malcolm X Centre, where I vote. But, I mean, with George Ferguson, I had, when he first announced his candidacy, I had a thing through the door then. A couple of months after that, another thing through the door. It was like almost like a sort of drip, drip, slow drip campaign.
It was a well-resourced campaign,
With Marvin, I only got one thing through the door. The other thing was there was stuff arriving through the door last weekend from the George Ferguson campaign. He's got his own logo. He's got his own website. He's got his own Twitter feed. All these kinds of things that nowadays go with corporate public relations. I did actually have a little look to see who is running his PR campaign. Nothing actually about that on the website at all. So no transparency as to where all this, how much money's been spent on George's public relations, and who is actually doing it.
I think this is the sort of nuts and bolts question that we've got to go away as the Labour Party and ask. How do you win campaigns in the modern era? We're relying very much on the old style thing of identifying our supporters, knocking on their doors, speaking to them personally, and so on. But of course, if that is not actually communicating in the same kind of way as using, for example, mass media, leaflet drops, whatever. I mean, we'll need to look at how George ran his campaign, and so will everybody else who's playing in politics. And we're always learning from each other, aren't we?
I think he was just more appealing, to be honest. I mean, I wrote a blog about this, saying there are two types of politicians, and it's not Labour Lib Dem or Liberal Tory, whatever. It's pluralist and tribalist.
Yeah.
I think most politicians you can put in one of those two boxes. Are they someone who reaches out? Are they inclusive? Do they recognise they don't have all the right answers, and some other people have got some good points to make? That's a pluralist. Are you a tribalist? My party is always right. Everyone else is always wrong. And I'm afraid Bristol Labour Party have definitely given the impression for a very long period of time that they're a doctrinaire force, and all of their leading councillors never really want to work with anyone else. I think one of the huge mistakes that Marvin made in the campaign was saying that if he was elected mayor, he would only have Labour councillors in his administration rather than people from other parties.
But I mean, surely, Stephen, what's going on here? The electorate are saying to you, we don't like party politics. Actually, that's what they're saying. And in fact, in a way, there, by having a go at Marvin, you know, you're playing that game that people are saying they won't want people playing.
No, I'm recognising what people don't like about some aspects of party politics. They don't like the tribal aspect of it, that I'm always right, you're always wrong side of it. They want politicians to work together and compromise. Well, at least that's what they say, although sometimes when you form a coalition, as we're doing nationally, people don't like that either. So one of the things you learn in politics is that you can't it's heads we win, tails you lose.
George has made a big thing about the £5 million worth of savings he wants to make, rather than using the word cuts. Again, this smacks of a bit of public relations, doesn't it?
Well, it's going to be a big challenge for him over the next few years. It's going to be a very difficult time for him and his administration of wielding the axe, if you want to use a more colourful metaphor, to expenditure in the city in order to get things back in line.
Martin, I'm laying off you for being a Labour Party person and having failed today for one moment. This is a millionaire. He's a millionaire, he was saying last week, apparently, George Ferguson.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's hardly a secret.
Yeah, but you know, do you think that makes a difference, his connections with the business community, the merchants, this kind of thing?
I think to some of those who voted for him, the fact that he has got a track record of doing things and being successful at them obviously counts. There's no doubt about that.
You mean the things like the tobacco factory, the canteen?
Exactly. He can point to things he's actually done.
Can I just pick up another point about
tribalism and non-tribalism? And when we had all of the mayoral candidates, apart from Marvin, on our show the other week, there was a general consensus about quite a lot of things. Because in actual fact, this is a progressive city with progressive values. And even Jeff Gollop, who's the Conservative candidate, was talking in a progressive way about doing things about inequality in the city. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the kind of city Bristol is. Yeah. And I think that's why we all like living here. And, I think that George Ferguson has demonstrated his right to run the place. And if he comes up with things which are constructive, I can't see that the Labour Party is going to be involved in the administration. That doesn't make a lot of sense. I can't see that there'll be any consensus about that. But if sensible things are suggested, I would hope that sensible Labour councillors will support them.
OK, we've got some interesting results to do with the other election that was going on, the yellow bit of paper, for those of you that voted out there, which is not very many. I think the average across the country was 16. In a way, I feel like applauding Newport, who was the only place ever, I think, in this country ever, who's had a polling station where not a single person turned out to vote for the Police and Crime Commissioner in South Wales. But the voting in the Somerset PCC elections has gone on to a second round, we've just heard. Second round of voting. The top two candidates after the first round were independent Sue Mount-Stevens and Conservative Ken Maddock. Sue Mount-Stevens won 35, roughly 36% of the vote, compared to 25% of the electorate who voted for Mr. Maddock. Liberal Democrat Pete Levy was third, 18% of the vote, 19% of the vote, and Labour's John Savage came in fourth place with 21% of the vote. So that is now going to be a longer vote, as the second votes are counted for Sue Mount-Stevens and the Conservative Ken Maddock.
What was the turnout?
The turnout, I think, around about 20%, because we also had the Bristol mayor election, which made more people turn out within Bristol. But first of all, Stephen, what about this result in Newport? This is incredible. Not a single person turning out to vote in an entire polling station. A whole day, they're sitting around doing nothing.
I suspect neither you or I, Tony, are experts on the demographics of Newport, so I think you need to know more about the particular polling district to say anything sensible about that. But on Avon and Somerset, I mean, I talked to loads of people this week while I was out on the streets in shopping centres and on the centre yesterday with John Rogers. And when I said to people, and you've got the police commissioner election, particularly if they said, you know, I live in Lawn Ashton, I live in Thornbury or something, people just said, I don't care about it. It really shouldn't be happening. I don't want a police commissioner. I'm going to spoil my ballot paper. I'm not going to bother voting. I think an awful lot of people, particularly in Bristol, voted for the mayor, and then when they got the yellow ballot paper you referred to, just probably voted independent without even thinking about it, because apart from the Mount-Stevens name being associated with cream cakes or something, if you've lived in Bristol for a long time, no one would have had the faintest idea of what Mrs. Mount-Stevens.
Oh, to be fair, apart from avid listeners to this show who would have heard the four candidates a couple of weeks ago.
Okay,
Fair enough. But
if you wanted to find out, but the point is, you would have to have wanted desperately to have found out what these police commissioner candidates were standing for in order to discover it, and you know, most people wouldn't have wanted to do that. I think the post should never have been created. I'm not sure what problem it's designed to solve, creating another directly elected politician. You know, no one has ever said to me, you know, what I really want to make the police accountable is another politician who I can vote for in order to do that, because frankly they can come and see me or they can come and see their councillors.
Well, there's something perverse about this, isn't there? Because we've got a vote against party politics in the mayor elections, and in the police and crime commissioners we have been told you must vote, and almost certainly you're going to be voting for a political party, which is really interesting to see that people appear to have voted for mostly for Sue Mount Stevens as an independent, as you were just saying, almost saying rejecting the idea of having party politics in the running of the police, Martin.
Well, and if 20% participated, 80% didn't, and I think this is something about, I mean, the whole issue of police commissioners is something about which Stephen and I would probably agree. A totally unnecessary election which cost millions of pounds, which could have been spent on frontline policing and so on. And the other Liberal Democrats around the country, I believe in Kidderminster, they didn't run anybody for that very reason. But of course, I do have to make the point that it is your government that decided to do this. And of course, you know,
I don't agree with everything my government does.
No.
Isn't there anything there you can do, Stephen, you know, as someone who's involved at a fairly high level in national politics, to sort of torpedo silly ideas like this when they come along? Because clearly, this is something that the people don't want. They've just simply said they haven't voted. You know, this is a very clear signal. This is something we don't want. And also, what is far less democratic? What we've got in some parts of the countries now is superintendents overseeing an entire massive police budgets, which to me is absolutely perverse, crazy idea. A superintendent is a senior policeman. They are much more likely to be loyal to their other senior police friends than they are to members of the public. It seems like we're going down the Gotham City road of, you know, US style policing.
Well, I think US style policing, you've put your finger on it, Tony. I think this is what the conservative side of the coalition saw as attractive, a directly elected politician over the police, probably running on a law and order ticket. And they probably thought that that would play to traditional Tory party strengths, and although Labour Party under Blair tried to claim that ground as well. And it's backfired. It's backfired pretty spectacularly, I would say. One, because of public indifference, as you were saying, 80% of people, even more than that, I think in some parts of the country, up to 90% of people haven't taken part in these elections. But if independent people have been elected too, then it's not been a triumph for the Conservative Party. But I think a lot of people in Britain, where we don't have this history of politicians being directly involved in the police, think it's a really bad thing to do. And what people were saying to me is, we don't want politicisation of the British police. It's very important that they are independent.
Well, I think I totally agree with that. And I think, I'll be honest with you, I spoiled my ballot paper yesterday. I didn't want to vote for any of them. And I think that's the message that the government should take from these elections and recognise that the authority that these police commissioners need is simply not there. And perhaps to go away and have a rethink about what's going on with the, you know, the democratic control of policing.
Yeah. Yeah. I think we're joined on the line now by Rob Mitchell. Hi, Rob.
Hi, Tony.
Rob, you're down at the count at the moment. Could you just give us a sort of latest from down there? What have you been finding out?
I'm just leaving, actually. The police commissioner second stage is about to go on now, which I've sadly got to leave for, but I can tell you that Sue Mount Stevens is way ahead, the independent candidate, with something like 83,000 votes, and the Maddox, the Conservative candidate, was behind.
Okay, what about with the mayor elections, though? What's the general feeling down there? Because many people were expecting this to be a walkover for Labour, what with the Lib Dem coalition nationally being around for 2 years, a lot of disillusionment with the way that things have been going, particularly with all these cuts, the swinging cuts. What was the reaction from the Labour group?
Oh, I think the Labour group are very gutted. I mean, I will say that one of the reasons I was here today is because we've been doing a film with Marvin Rees, actually, an independent film, and really a slightly different agenda, about really about a black candidate in Bristol taking political leadership. That's what the film was about. So it meant that we had a little bit more of an insight into the Labour campaign. And so I can tell you that they were very gutted indeed. However, if you look at the results, I think Marvin summed it up very well in his speech to the media. I mean, they did poll something like 31,000 votes against George's 37,000. And I think what you'll see by the collapse of the Conservative and the Lib Dem numbers is that a lot of the votes went from those two parties over to George. So in a sense, it was three parties against two other parties against the one, really, if you in terms of traditional parties and numbers, I think. That's what I think the analysis was.
Okay. Well, there's also the fact, though, that, you know, really it should have been a bit of a walkover. For this is a traditional Labour city for many years. The reaction seems to be that, you know, you've what you were saying there, we've got sort of three main parties, the Conservatives, Lib Dem and Labour. And the Conservative and Lib Dem both went for George. But, I mean, ultimately, what's the, in the analysis that's, that people are talking about down there, what do they think was the one thing that was missing from Marvin's campaign that may have tipped the balance?
To give you, just give you a sec about the numbers a second. John for Lib Dem Johns polled 6,200 votes after the first stage. The Conservative Jeff Gallup polled 8,100 votes, and then Labour polled 25,000 votes. Also, and then George polled 31,000. So, I mean, given that we normally have that kind of tripartite situation, it's obvious that George managed to convince Bristol that Bristol First was the way to go. Certainly, the word on the street always was that we don't want traditional party politics and we want an independent candidate. Now, this, I think, even despite the very low turnout at 27.92%, very low, I think George managed to convince Bristol that that was the sell. Bristol First, not party politics. And that, I think, was the big problem.
OK, Rob Mitchell from the Count up at the University of West of England, thanks very much for joining us on Drive Time. That was, I think, a little bit of an interesting insight there, Martin. I mean, in a way, what he's saying is that George has been the key factor. The idea of an independent coming in has really stripped the votes away from what otherwise might have been a Labour victory.
I don't think he's stripped that many votes from Labour. It's just that we've not been able to reach out beyond our core constituency. And I think also, of course, don't forget, in general elections, turnouts are significantly higher than this. And that tends to favour us, which could, of course, lead to complacency, which it shouldn't. I think there's a lot of questions for us to answer here.
I just about a lot of Labour voters stayed at home. As you say, the turnout was very low in some traditional Labour wards. I think it was barely above 10% in some of them. So I think the election failed to capture the imagination of vast numbers of Bristolians. I think everyone, including George, actually needs to.
I mean, wouldn't it be interesting if Sue Mount Stevens as well wins later this evening when the final results are announced for Police and Crime Commission, where we've got two independents now? It really is a quite round rejection of party politics, Stephen.
It's a bit of a leap in the dark, that one. At least with George, you know, he's a rounded product. We know,
but it's, you know, not. He's not Sue was on the police authority. She's been on there for years. I mean, so it's not really a leap in the dark
other than her surname, because it was a bakery, I know nothing about it.
Yeah, so she's been on the police authority.
I don't know what she's going to do as the police commissioner, and her remit is going to extend, you know, all the way from Minehead to Thornbury. So how she's going to be accountable to people over the next 4 years, I don't know. And I guess all these commissioners will be doing their job in different ways. But again, I'm not, come back to what I said earlier, I'm not sure what problem this post is meant to solve.
Okay, on to some other news this week, and to start with, let's have a look at Starbucks. This is quite an interesting one, possibly for you, Stephen. You used to work, I think, for PricewaterhouseCoopers, didn't you?
I did.
As a tax advisor. Now, you know, in many ways, this whole business of Starbucks not paying any tax in Britain could be said to sort of emanate from the sorts of advice that PricewaterhouseCoopers were giving. So anyway, let's have a listen now to Monday at the House of Commons, where we have the Public Accounts Committee, and Margaret Hodge, she's questioning Troy Alstead, who's the Chief Financial Officer of Starbucks.
If you've made losses in the UK, which is what you're filing, over 15 years, what on earth are you doing business here?
We know that we must be in the UK to be a successful global company.
But you're losing money here.
It's a critical market.
Why don't you go over to the US, focus on the US, where you say you're making money,
because
if it's true?
We've had tremendous optimism and encouragement over time about our ability.
15 years, Mr. Alstead. You've given the UK business 15 years. You're still making losses, and yet you're carrying on, if it's true.
Yes, I assure you it is true.
We're sceptical of your story because I think the allegation is that the way in which you set charges against the UK business means that you manipulate the profits out of the UK into tax havens.
Respectfully, I can assure you there's no tax avoidance here. We have a global tax rate of 33% around the world. our tax rate outside of the U.S. is 21%, as it will be filed with the SEC next week. That's higher than most multinationals' global tax rate. We are an extremely high taxpayer. We clearly are not aggressively looking to avoid tax or looking to avoid tax on any structure anywhere. We have had profitability challenges, very sincere ones, unfortunately, that we're not pleased with. But it is nothing, I assure you, nothing to do with any tax avoidance.
Now, Stephen, you're not on the Public Accounts Committee, but if you were, would you believe him?
It's implausible. I mean, I was the first Member of Parliament to talk about Starbucks a few weeks ago and to raise the issue in Parliament, and it's the latest in a long line of sort of well-known household names who've got dodgy tax dealings, if I can put it that way. Amazon would be another example. Facebook pay very little tax.
Google.
In the UK, Google. A lot of things that, you know, many of us use every day, because they're pretty hard to avoid. You can avoid Starbucks, of course. There's plenty of choice of where you drink your coffee, particularly.
But Boots is another one. And I would just like to flag up at this point that actually the UK Uncut website is an excellent resource. Mm. For anyone that wants to decide where they spend their money on the high street, thinking, well, are these people actually paying their tax? Go to UK Uncut.
And there's several players involved here in dealing with the problem. First of all, there's our own government to make sure our own tax code is tight, and the Inland Revenue is having a good look at these companies, at what they're doing. Because, you know, what Starbucks and several other companies will be doing is probably having high sort of intercompany rates. They'll probably be charging the UK company a fee for using the Starbucks name, probably something for the crockery they use. The coffee beans will be bought in one country, sold to another subsidiary in another country at a markup, then sold to the UK at a bigger markup, and then they end up with a loss. Whereas everyone knows, if you go to any of these coffee shops and you cough up £2.80, say, for a latte, the unit price of a cup of coffee is in pence. It probably costs, you know, 20p, say, to make a cup of coffee. So the margin that any company is making on coffee is absolutely enormous as a consumer product. It's very easy, therefore, to make money out of coffee shops. Yet we're asked to believe that Starbucks has been making a loss, as Margaret Hodge was saying in that clip, for over 15 years. And it doesn't add up.
No,
Stephen,
it doesn't make sense. You're known now. I think it's just a few weeks ago you announced that you were boycotting Starbucks. But I question that, because, you know, you were part of the problem originally, weren't you? You were advising these big companies on how they can legally avoid tax. So which side of the line are you on here? Because we wonder, you know, are you now a real gamekeeper, poacher-turned-gamekeeper, or are you keeping your eye on the main chance and wondering that when you finish being an MP, you're going to get a nice directorship at PricewaterhouseCoopers or maybe even Starbucks?
nice try. Look, whether it's in my professional career,
you
or
certainly
my
know a lot
career,
about
which
this.
At that time ran in parallel. You know, all professional advisors, whether they're PwC or other companies, advise their clients what they can do to minimise their tax bills within the law, but always steering them directly along that path within the law, and often clients ended up paying more than they would otherwise have.
But being Starbucks are doing here is legal. No one's saying it's illegal.
Yeah.
But I mean, we've created this crazy regime.
And I started saying to you earlier, there are several players involved. One's our own UK government and our own tax code. You know, there's consumer power. You just mentioned that people can actually boycott.
But they only have to do that when the government doesn't do its job, can't they?
The only way that things are going to really change is looking at the international tax treaties within the big sort of family of large economies, the so-called OECD, where you have model tax treaties in between countries which regulate how you move money, hot money, around the world, and that's where cooperation is required. And I was pleased that our Chancellor, George Osborne, was talking to his German counterpart a couple of weeks ago about increasing that sort of cross-border cooperation,
but actually doing
up the ability for companies to move money about.
Stephen, not doing anything. Talking, yes, but I mean, for example, taxresearch.org.uk, I was having a look at, there's quite a lot of this revolving doors going on. Former PricewaterhouseCoopers staffer Mark Hoban was the recently, up until recently anyway, the financial secretary to the Treasury. Nicholas Thomas Montague, one-time chief of the Inland Revenue, has joined PricewaterhouseCoopers in 2004. You know, surely you must be thinking, you must be torn between, what do I do here with the knowledge that I've got about tax avoidance? Do I use that to save the public purse, or do I use it to get myself a nice job?
Well, I think if you look at my record as a Member of Parliament over the last 7 years, you'll find that I've probably talked more about the practices of companies or rich individuals in terms of avoiding tax much more than any other MP within the government. I have to say, much more than Labour MPs as well over the last 2.5 years and over the time that they were in government. So I think my personal record speaks for itself.
Okay, Martin, can I just get Martin on this? PricewaterhouseCooper partner Richard Abadi had been the head of private finance initiative policy at the Treasury in June 2009. Former PricewaterhouseCooper's partner Amias Morse was appointed UK Comptroller and Auditor General, became responsible for directing the National Audit Office. Martin.
Well, I mean, there is a problem with revolving doors in this, but let's face it, if you're going to catch out the clever tax cheats, you're going to need some people who understand what's going on. As you so rightly said, poachers and gamekeepers earlier. And I understand from reading the Daily Mail today, not that I always take the Daily Mail series, that Margaret Hodge has got some serious questions about her own personal tax affairs, which of course have now been dragged into the light as a result of the stance she was taking on our clip there. I think the real problem is that all multinational companies, not just Starbucks, engage in transfer pricing, which is a technical term for basically manipulating their accounts to show their profits in the countries where the taxes are least. And it's very difficult to control. It's been going on for a very long time, and it is the power of multinational companies to basically blackmail national governments, even big national governments like Britain, never mind poor countries like Bangladesh, is enormous.
Stephen,
it's a big problem.
We had on Question Time this week, we had Nigel Farage from the UK Independence Party saying that actually the root of the problem here is EU regulations.
There's a surprise.
Now, yes, but I mean, he's absolutely right, isn't he?
The EU
allows these companies to move their profits around Europe. Surely it's the EU.
The EU is part of the solution to this, as well as the OECD, which includes countries outside Europe. The European Union is potentially part of the solution.
But you're saying the single market wasn't EU?
Yeah. Well, the single market, if it was generally a single market in all senses, would have a common corporate tax code, right across the 27 member states, and would stop the sort of competition in corporation tax rates. The Facebook problem, and we all use, well, I do anyway, I use Facebook, and the vast majority of people listening to this program use Facebook as well, but they are based in Dublin. The Republic of Ireland has a corporation tax rate of 12%.
But many of these companies,
UK corporation tax is currently 24%.
Many of these companies are making their money in Switzerland, which isn't even in the EU. So, I mean, surely this is really, this is the big companies themselves, and the companies like PricewaterhouseCoopers that are helping them, that have made it so that people like pensioners. There was a very good article in the Daily Mail last week about how the HM Revenue and Customs is bullying many pensioners to pay extra amounts of tax, threatening them with all sorts of things. And yet, you know, many of these big corporations who are absolutely overloaded with cash are walking off scot-free.
Yeah, well, international cooperation is the answer, whether it's through a sort of formal union of states like the European Union, or whether it's through other international organisations such as the OECD. So Nigel Farage, you know, thinks Britain would be better floating off in the mid-Atlantic, nothing to do with Europe. I think that's completely bonkers viewpoint. The EU is part of the solution to this issue.
Martin, I'll give a final word to you on this. How do we stop this ridiculous billions of tax avoidance by these massive companies like Starbucks?
I think the answer is, as outlined by Stephen, we need international cooperation and a seriousness about that international cooperation. But I think the fiscal crisis, which is facing states all over the world, forces a concentration of minds here, doesn't it? I mean, how long can any government in Britain or anywhere else carry on cutting essential public services while money is being squirreled away in essentially tax havens, which are actually onshore? They're not even in the Cayman Islands.
Okay.
And I think this is going to be an issue for whoever is running Britain. it's going to be an issue for whoever's
well,
running.
Well, I mean, it's always job. Easy. And both of you have said, oh, it's someone else's problem. The EU's got to sort it out. Anyway,
we're in the EU. We can contribute to the solution if we work constructively with our European neighbours.
Well, let's hope we do. I'm afraid I'm a little bit sceptical about whether that's really going to happen.
On that point, David Cameron cut a deal with the Swiss authorities recently, did he not? Which actually undermined a collective approach by the Europeans, which would have actually got a better deal.
Okay. Let's go on to the next story. It's Children in Need tonight on the BBC, but Shelter have announced this week 75,000 children are going to be homeless in London over Christmas, the biggest Christmas homelessness crisis since World War II. This is Shelter's figures, Martin, 75,000 homeless children in London.
I think homelessness is becoming a major issue, and it was one of the major issues that we tried to highlight during the campaign here in Bristol. Housing is a major issue, especially in a high rent, high property price place like Bristol. And I hope that George Ferguson, as the mayor, will put homelessness as one of his priorities, and that we can do something about low-income people who find it virtually impossible to get anywhere decent to live.
Stephen, one of the big problems over the last couple of years is that the bottom half of people who are in work, their actual income has gone down 15% or so. Now, we haven't seen rents going down, have we? I mean, what's happening is you've got a kind of squeeze here with energy prices, which we'll be talking about in the second hour with Friends of the Earth. Energy prices going up, all sorts of things like outgoings either staying the same or going up, and yet, relatively speaking, we're getting less money in. There is a quote from Mr. McCorber, isn't there? Martin was mentioning this on the way back. We were leaving the studio last week, which I'd love to read out. Wilkins McCorber is a fictional character from Charles Dickens' 1850 novel David Copperfield, modelled on Dickens' father, who, like McCorber, was incarcerated in a debtor's prison, which was the King's Bench prison, after failing to meet his creditors' demands. The quote is as follows: McCorber is known for asserting his faith that something will turn up. I'll get the quote right now, based on an observation. He says, "The annual income of £20, annual expenditure £19, 19 and 6. Result? Happiness. Annual income £20, annual expenditure £20, out and 6. Result? Misery." And that's where a lot of people are now, Stephen, on the bottom half of the working population. And we keep hearing from the Conservatives that you're better off on benefits than you are on work. That's not actually true. But the actual benefit of going into work for that bottom half of the working population is becoming less and less every week.
Yeah, and you could apply that metaphor from Dickens to the state of the national finances as well. When the coalition came to office, essentially, the country was living a 40 grand lifestyle on a 30 grand salary. To put it in simple terms, for every £4 the government spent, he was only collecting £3 in taxes. So the national finances were in a pretty dreadful state as well. Yeah, but on individual households, yes, I see that absolutely. That costs, you know, every time you go to put diesel in your car, you get the electric bill, it is going up.
But we've seen this.
And the pressure that people are under. In terms of what the government is doing, in one of the big changes that the Lib Dems have brought to the coalition, is actually raising the income tax threshold. So if you are in work and you're taking home salary, the amount you will take home after tax is actually going up. But so that's direct help.
Well, yeah, but that doesn't help people who have maybe got part-time work and are still having to claim housing benefit. We've heard that over half the new housing benefit claims now are for people who cannot pay the rent, even though they're in work.
Yes, well, obviously it does help because they get more of their net income to keep and spend in whatever way that they choose. But the government is also having a big programme of welfare reform. I've just done my advice surgery this afternoon. As with virtually every surgery I've done in the last 7.5 years, somebody comes with a benefits problem of difficulty from moving from housing benefit to job seekers allowance, council tax benefits, DLA, and so on. So the government is embarking on a programme of welfare reform to have something called universal credit by next year, which would be a simpler benefit, bringing together all the different types of benefits that have evolved over the last sort of 80 to 100 years together in one simple cash benefit that people can understand. It should make it easier to move either in between worklessness or in work, or if you're in work, given you the extra support that you need.
But why aren't the government moving on these energy companies? I mean, the price of fuel is going up, even though is staying the same, or maybe going down 2p, when we hear the wholesale price of fuel has gone down 10 pence in the last month. So they're basically taking the mickey, aren't they? They are utterly unregulated. They can charge what they want. They know we need to get to work, so we'll have to pay whatever they demand. It's like a racket, essentially.
I don't necessarily disagree with the language you're using there.
And so why aren't you doing anything?
The Energy Secretary, colleague mine, Ed Davey, and the Prime Minister as well, have been saying that the government intends to get tough with the energy companies, but we need to see that work through.
Yes, when?
Well, that they are talking about it now, but we obviously need to see the action.
Martin, what about this whole business of the Micawber effect? You know, if you've got your income is a tiny amount less than your outgoings, then it's misery, isn't it?
Yes, it is. But I think also you've got to recognise that a national economy doesn't function like a household budget. And I think this is one of the fundamental failings of imagination of the coalition government. Because what's happening is, by attempts to rein in the public sector deficit before, they're leading to a situation where the economy is actually being undermined. Now, I'm not saying that you can forever run deficits. You can't. But I think it's economic illiteracy to imagine that you can immediately put the brakes on and that you will then reduce the deficit. It's quite clear that the government are not going to reach their deficit targets. We're halfway through the parliament now. They're not going to reach them. And by the time we get to the next election, it's quite possible that the economy will be in recession. It's quite possible we'll be in recession now as we speak, a triple dip recession. Now, if you're in a recession, the last thing, you can't cut your way out of a recession. And this would be the same dilemma would face any Labour government. But I think there's been a mismanagement or a misperception of the problem. And I think ultimately, when the history of this period becomes to be written, it will be seen that George Osborne as the Chancellor made the wrong choices for the wrong reasons.
And Stephen, hasn't George Osborne just made this problem worse? The nearly 60,000 children homeless in London over Christmas?
Well, you've just presented that information to me. I'll have to look.
Well, it's Shelter's report. It's Shelter's. It's actually Shelter's report this week.
Yeah, but I can't imagine that 75,000 children, which is what you've just shown me, children are going to be made homeless.
No, they're not being made homeless. They will be homeless. That means
it's an existing problem.
Yes,
that isn't getting.
That is getting worse. Yeah, and this is for people who are children who are sleeping on sofas, have got some form of temporary housing, that is, for example, in bed and breakfast and this kind of thing.
Yeah, and part of the reason for that, obviously there are many factors in it, is the unbalanced way our country has been built up, that we have an overheated economy in the southeast and London, lots of people wanting to live there and not enough accommodation being available, so people living in dreadful conditions. You've seen these aerial photographs of people living in what I would call sheds and garages at the bottom of people's gardens in some parts of London, which is pretty terrible.
Well,
that's taking place.
I can remember.
But that's because we have an unbalanced economy with too much of a draw to London, whereas other cities like Liverpool and Salford and parts of Newcastle and whatever, there'll be empty houses.
Well, they seem to have got rid of it now, but on the Bath, if you come out of Bath on the left-hand side on the train, there was a whole load of people living in tents, migrant workers mostly, I would say about 100 of them living in tents in Woodland near that. You say, so this is a serious problem. It isn't going away. One of the people responsible for our economy is King Mervyn. I thought he was just about to move on, Mervyn King, the governor of the Bank of England. But anyway, he was speaking again this week, and he's still there, and he's talking about zigging and zagging in that amazing soporific voice that he has.
Output grew strongly in the third quarter. Welcome as that is, it is not a reliable guide to the future. Just as growth in Q2 was depressed by one-off factors and gave a misleadingly weak picture of the economy, so growth in Q3 has been boosted by one-off factors and gives an overly optimistic impression of the underlying trend. We face the rather unappealing combination of a subdued recovery with inflation remaining above target for a while. An unfavourable external environment continues to shape our prospects. The international imbalances which played such a pivotal role in the run-up to the crisis still remain. The pattern of surplus countries reluctant to expand domestic demand to protect their trade position, and deficit countries restraining domestic spending to reduce their debt ratios is only too familiar. It's a recipe for weak global growth.
Well, it's, as you say, a rather soporific presentation. It sounded a bit like the weather forecast, you know, the one they do about round Britain, you know, Cromarty 7.
Well, he always talks about it being like some sort of storm running over the country, doesn't he? But he's essentially saying there's nothing we can do. That's his bottom
line.
Well,
I mean, there are limits to what any British government can do, but I think the point is that if we do go into a triple dip recession, and I'm pretty confident that we will, then it's a clear evidence that the policy being pursued is just flawed. And I think that ultimately we won't end up reducing the deficit by as much as the coalition suspects they want to, but it won't necessarily be a disaster, because ultimately that basically protects your economy, because you have debt is the alternative to bankruptcy.
But what about this language of zigging and zagging? I mean, it sounds like he's tacking in the storm.
Well, what he's saying there is fairly straightforward, is that the economy is not doing anything very much. It's showing some signs of life and then it's collapsing again, and I think, I'm afraid, that's where we are. And of course there's a real danger with external shocks like the fiscal cliff coming up in the US or the collapse of the euro, that there's going to be a tsunami which is really going to knock us for six, which nobody in Britain can do anything about.
I've been doing these shows with you two for many years on and off now, and Martin's always this prophet.
This
of
is
doom.
True. This
we're
is
always,
true.
We're always approaching that collapse, that tsunami around the corner. Look, I mean, the economy is still in a very difficult place, but a lot of the indicators are now going in the right direction. Unemployment has been falling consistently. Youth unemployment, you know, which really is, I think, the worst part of unemployment, has been falling.
But we have been bucking the trend here in Bristol. We have actually been bucking the trend. Whilst nationally unemployment's going down, they said this week that Bristol has gone up slightly. So that's not a good sign for this part of the world, is it?
Well, you're going from 1 month to another is always dangerous in any statistics. Yeah. You need to look at a long-term trend. And actually, youth unemployment in Bristol has been falling this year, but interest rates are still low. You know, you mentioned in the cost pressures on people's households earlier. Mortgage rates are still incredibly low. The government itself borrows at a very low rate. That's incredibly important, because we're still going to be borrowing probably right up until 2017 before we clear the deficit. So it's in our interests for international lending rate to our country to be low, and that's because the rest of the world has confidence that the government is on track.
So I'm glad to hear, Stephen, that we're not going to be like Athens in the next few weeks anyway.
No way.
Okay, the final story. West Somerset Council's long-term future is in question. Fresh doubts have been raised in Somerset over the long-term future of England's smallest district council. The local government association published a report which highlights concerns over the viability of West Somerset Council. Apparently we've got a government minister going down there next week to see what they can do, because this is going bust. They can't survive. West Somerset Council has had it.
Oh dear. I'm sure if there are any listeners in Minehead, they'll be very upset to hear that. I mean, I don't know whether we've got time to even go into this, but I think the structure of local government, and I mentioned the dismemberment of Avon County Council earlier, is something that we really do need to sort out as a country. Michael Heseltine, in his report to the government last week on how to further stimulate growth, said we need a more rational structure of local government rather than the mess that's sort of sprung up piecemeal since Victorian times that we've got at the moment. And of course in Somerset they still have these two-tier authorities of small district councils like West Somerset and Somerset County Council.
But Stephen,
and unitary councils, I personally think, are
it's your fault.
Forward.
It's your fault as from central really? Government. Yes, oh, okay. Central government's fault. 2 years ago, Mr. Taylor, who's the council leader, said the council could collapse after grants, when the coalition government came in, were reduced by £600,000. That's 17% reduction in their government grants. That must be a factor in this.
It won't surprise you, Tony, to know I'm not an expert on the finances of West Somerset Council. You know, I like to read myself up into all sorts of things, but I'm not an expert on that particular local authority.
Oh, maybe Starbucks have got a few bob they could buy it up, Martin.
I think the bankruptcy of local government is a clear and present threat in the United States, for example, like big cities going bankrupt. And I think, I'm afraid, I'm still sticking to my doom predictions.
Which are, go on, just remind
which
us.
Which are that the downside risks are enormous. The euro is still not sorted out. The banks are still insolvent. There's going to be a fiscal row in the US, which will possibly cause a panic on the markets, and a war in the Middle East, which may also do the same.
Okay, well, that's now time for the Murdoch News at 6 o'clock. Thanks very much to this week's guest, Lib Dem MP for Bristol West, Stephen Williams. After the news, the energy vampires. Wholesale petrol prices going down 10 pence a litre in the last month, but the price at the pump only went down tuppence.
This This is BCFM 93.2, the community station for Bristol. Listen live online at bcfm.org.uk. BCFM News from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 6, Lord Prescott has failed to win the police commissioner...